WTIP, and we're joined in studio right now but with Lane Kennedy. And Lane is a well-known photographer throughout this area and also throughout the country. He's had photographs in the Smithsonian and the National Geographic, the New York Times, Sports Illustrated, Life Magazine. Lane, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great.
You know, it'd help if I had your mic on.
Okay, I'll say it again. Thanks. That's great. And I love Roadhouse. What a great name.
There you go. You know, as I look through those titles of where you've been published, that's a wide spectrum of magazines. It's not like just Audubon and National Geo.
Right, not one publication. It's kind of a survival thing. I mean, rather than being a specialty, you kind of shoot for a lot of different publications, and so it allows you to grow in many different ways, and so that opens new doors, you know.
And when I looked on your website, I think you describe yourself as a editorial feature story photographer.
Correct.
Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at, you know, Newsweek, Time, and the guys that are true hardcore photojournalists, you know, newspapers and what have you, they're shooting news and events for the most part. Mm-hmm. And as a feature photography, I'm allowed a little bit more leeway in that I can take time telling a story through that period of time rather than having to deal with the instant of something that happens, a news event. And so we're able to get in a little bit deeper, and so telling the story. And that's kind of how these workshops, like the one at the North House, has evolved, is that the workshop here at the North House is a storytelling, learning to tell stories about the area. And so it kind of is a perfect blend for me to be able to go that way based on the work that I do in telling stories with pictures. So a lot of fun.
And we haven't mentioned to the audience out there yet, but you are teaching a 5-day class down at North House.
Correct.
You're kind of partway through it.
Yep, halfway through it now.
Yeah, and you teach one in the summer, and then you come back again in October.
We have fall equinox. We get to see the pretty leaves and the cold weather, which I prefer.
And great participation down there in your class. So it's something that people are lined up to get into.
I hope so. Yeah. I'm glad you said that. That's a nice way to look at it.
Yeah, I think you broke it up at 14 because logistically it gets too difficult after
it's
that.
It's too many people, yeah.
Yeah. When did you decide? I read a little bit. I had a hard time finding much of a bio in your website.
Oh,
so
really?
You're a little shy about putting all those things out. But I did read in there that you came down from Alaska.
Yeah, I grew up in Alaska
and went to school at UMD.
Yep.
And managed on your first Boundary Waters trip to drop your camera in the water.
Oh my gosh, you know about that, huh?
A kind of an inauspicious start for how life has gone for you.
Yeah, it's not as bad as the time I left the camera on top of the car and drove away and saw it in my rearview mirror, but we won't talk about that one, okay?
Okay, we'll leave that one out of the story here.
But yeah, you know, it happens. It was a great introduction, I thought, to the Boundary Waters. Oh, I'm sorry, did I do something?
No.
Bob, did we have something we need to do?
No. You're just the arm of your chair, I think, is banging on.
Oh.
Thing. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's probably it's my camera. Perfect. About ready to fall
there
off the counter.
Go.
That's
yeah.
Got to be what it is.
Lane set his camera down, and it's falling off the edge.
Some of our equipment here is chair-wise.
You think
maybe
so?
Not 100%.
You think?
Lane got the only good chair.
He did. We reserve them for our in-studio.
It's not squeaking or anything.
Guests.
I love this.
That's right, yeah. Now, how did you decide? I mean, you've had a great career telling stories yourself. Feature stories. You've been in so many different magazines. You've got a number of books out, and we're going to talk about your latest book, you and Greg Brining.
Oh, Paddle North,
have just completed.
Wonderful book on the Boundary Waters.
But when did you decide that, you know, I have the ability to share this information in as a teacher?
You know, I think it's like anybody's job. Anything you do, it's kind of a transition, I think, especially with artistic type people. My training was in fine art photography. And the way you make a living in fine art photography is you teach. And I kind of hit a crossroads, and I'll never forget my college professor said, listen, you have to make a choice. You either can be a shooter or you can be a teacher. And being a teacher meant you had to teach 9 months out of the year, and I pretty much made it up my mind at that point that I wanted to be a shooter. But I don't mind sharing information. That's kind of the beauty of it. But I think what keeps photographers going, what keeps artists going in the process of telling stories is one of the great parts of telling stories with pictures is that every story you're assigned, within that story, you tend to find 5 other stories that evolve from that. So you never stop. The wheels are always turning. You finish this one and, geez, that guy I met has this boat building concept that is very interesting. Next thing you know, that's a story. Then that goes into something else and morphs into something else. And boy, the train just doesn't stop. And so you just keep riding and keep going. And any artistic ambition that people have, what you guys do, if you don't get rewards, you lose your motivation. And I think that's been the beauty of photography for me, is that I keep shooting and I keep getting rewards. Moments still continue to come. I still am in the right place at the right time through a combination of luck and research. And those things keep happening. So I keep coming back because I haven't gotten tired of that yet.
And how long have you been a photographer?
Well, you know, my dad was a military pilot. And so back in those days, you know, they used to always bring back camera equipment from Japan. And so Dad always had cameras growing up in Alaska, with Alaska being Alaska. We had a great photography program in high school. And so it was really easy to go use Dad's equipment because he never used it. And we'd go take pictures of each other skiing and canoe trips and rafting trips and what have you. So it just kind of became something that I was used to doing. And then once I jumped into that educational pool and started learning things a little bit more concise, you know, fine art and large format processing, all of these things, you start changing channels and you start finding things that you become really interested in, and then you just kind of gravitate towards that. So it's just a natural evolution process I think any artist goes through.
And how for you was it the transition to digital in your photography?
Well, I was kind of a holdout because you spent 20 years learning and feeling how film reacted to different subject matter. And so it became instinct. It's like a guitar player sitting down and playing chords, you know. And then if you go from a 16 string to a 12 string, it's different. And so you have to learn that. And I actually took my first digital photo by mistake. It was a book I was doing on the Apostle Islands, Jewels on the Water, a book we did on the Apostle Islands with Jeff Reneke. And I was going down one day on a storm to photograph the waves crashing into the shoreline. And so I had packed my digital camera and my film cameras, went down there expecting to shoot nothing but film. And of course, I got down there and I realized I had forgotten my film. Oh. You can see I'm a real bright guy. No, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer.
I'm seeing a pattern here, Lane.
So I was forced to shoot digital. And I tell you what, the great thing is that if I would had been shooting those waves interacting with the shoreline, I would have had to have taken any number of combinations to get what I want because I couldn't see it. I put the digital camera on, and within three frames, I saw exactly, because that immediate gratification you get by being able to see it. I went, oh my gosh, that's it. I was sold. And so from an expense standpoint, from an experience standpoint, rather than spending more than an hour or so to get that shot, I spent 10 minutes and was able to move on and do more work. So I was sold at that point. And that was, my gosh, that was 10, 12 years ago now.
I spent some time with Jim Brandenburg one year, and he had both cameras with him. On a little trip we were on, and he told me at that time that there were some things that work better digitally and some things that he still needed the film camera
for. You know, there are some things that you get from a feel with film, I think especially in black and white, that silver halide reaction with a print and with the chemicals that has a depth to it that mathematically created pixels don't have. Digital is still evolving. It's still getting to the point. It's almost there. There are still some things that haven't reached that. But again, from a teaching standpoint, the immediacy of being able to see results is a tremendous teaching tool. And being able to show people, this is how you can do it. Look, here it is. And I like that part of it because when I travel, we just got back from a trip in Vietnam, and being able to go and shoot kids and shoot people that you're photographing. Sometimes you put out on wide angle, for example, you come right up to them. They think you're shooting their nose. And then you show them what you just did, and they go, wow, look how much you're seeing. I can see the building behind me. They don't see it until you can show it to them. So that's a wonderful part of being able to share the medium and share your photography to somebody. You know, I like that.
Yeah. So you kind of now, that little experience you had kind of turned the corner for you with digital.
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't look back from that point on. I still shoot once in a while. I still shoot with Hasselblads, for example, and I still like the film concept that I get with that in black and white. There's just nothing that touches that Zeiss glass in black and white film. It's a marriage that shouldn't be dissolved.
I think Jim said that that shooting light gleaming on the water was something he couldn't get on his digital, but he could pick it up on even film. On the film, so you have to have an eye, you have to know.
Yeah, and that's part of that experience. You know, you shoot as much as you can, you learn, and that's really true. I mean, it's a good point with Jim, because there are certain things that, especially highlights, seem to be the way in digital, and also really bright colors like sunrises and sunsets. If you're shooting the disk of the sun, you start getting this weird banding That seems to be an inherent quality with digital that never happened with film. And so you're exactly right. There are some things you shy away from shooting in the digital world that you didn't, but of course that was true with film as well. You know, there are times with film that something's too dark to shoot and you just don't shoot it. But in digital, you can ramp up your ISO and get it. And that's been a big part of this workshop is people don't be afraid to shoot that dark part of the barn. It'll come out. And so that's really an eye-opener because most of us are used to shooting film. And so we haven't crossed that line yet where you feel comfortable using all of the capabilities that digital is able to offer us. And once you get to that point, you know, again, your world kind of opens up again and you have a new motivation, new excitement, and you come to Grand Marais.
We're speaking with Lane Kennedy, and Lane is up here teaching a class down at North House in photography for these 5 days. And he also brought up his latest book called Paddle North, which you can... combine with Greg Brining again,
as
you did in the previous book about ice fishing.
Yeah, ice fishing.
Which we had on earlier. I don't remember exactly what that time was, but we did. And I had a chance. I didn't have a chance to read it because I didn't get my paws on it till today. But I got a chance to look through it. And it's a lot more than photography. The photographs that you've done in there are beautiful.
Good, thank you.
But now you there, too, are telling a story.
Exactly.
Just as you've been talking about.
Well, you know, when we approached the Minnesota Historical Society Press, which is the publisher for both The Hard Water World, The Culture of Ice Fishing book, and Paddle North, if you look at book publishing, that if you go into a publisher and you say, we want to do a book on the Boundary Waters, and you have all these beautiful pictures, it's been done. It's been done over and over and over again. So when Greg and I approached them, Greg and I are both storytellers. We're both editorial journalists. And so we went and said, listen, we want to do a book on the Boundary Waters that tells the story of the Boundary Waters, not just pretty picture, pretty picture, pretty picture. So we've got a chapter in there on the history of the canoe, you know, a chapter on winter, a chapter on the ecology of fires, because I was caught in that Ham Lake fire here a few years ago. So it just worked perfect that it was we could fold that into the book. So it's a complete book. And I love that this book has a way that you don't get bored after five or six pictures of seeing kind of the same thing, this repetitiveness, which has a tendency to happen in picture books. This is one that Greg and I looked at. We said, we need to make a book that people that have paddled the Boundary Waters for 25 years will still pick this book up and learn something from it and get back to that same experience, almost like a scratch and sniff experience, if you can get that somehow. And that's the beauty of it. You know, I haven't gotten bored with it yet. In fact, now that it's been out, I've seen it for a year now. It's fun to go back because it's funny. I go back and look at it now, and it's like it's not my book. You know, you get a project, you bury it, you move on to something else. And so now when I go back to it, I look at the book much more objectively than I ever did when it came out, when it's so subjective. Oh, gosh, not that photo. Or no, it's too dark. Oh, you know, no, change this. Now I can look at it as a book, and I like that, and I like the book. I think it's a really nice book on the Boundary Waters in Quetico, and it's complete. It's not just the gunflint. And that was the problem that I faced in this book is that people who go to the Boundary Waters tend to either go up the North Shore and hit the Caribou, the Arrowhead, or the Gunflint. Other people you talk to only go to Ely. Other people only go to Loch LaCroix. And so 90% of my coverage, even though it was the Boundary Waters experience, was always here because I've always come up because I love Lake Superior. Then I realized, oh my gosh, I can't do a book and not have any images from the western side of the Boundary Waters. So a great deal of the coverage that I thought existed didn't exist, and so I had to go back out and kind of recover the Boundary Waters from a different perspective and a different place. And of course, that was, it's a tough job. Someone's got to do this, you know.
Yeah. Now, did Greg and you go out together?
We did not.
Oh, you didn't?
We did not. No, this was an unusual book. It's two very uniquely different perspectives, but a marriage in the end. Greg and I have traveled the world together on a number of different assignments, so we know each other. So when we came up with the format and came up with the title descriptions, it was very easy for me to go out and do my coverage and Greg to do his and then blend them together to make it work as one. And so it worked out really, really well.
You must have sat down and decided, okay, here's some themes that we want to catch.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
So the chapters were basically established before the coverage began.
Okay.
And so Greg knew what he was going to write about, and I then catered my imagery towards those chapters to fit with it. And one of the secrets with, I think, a good book is that you don't duplicate what the writer said with the photography. You want the photography to be as separate as the writing, so when they come together, the two experiences are very different. And so when you do that, then you get twice as much for your money. mm-hmm. and looking at something and two very different impressions about what you were covering than just one, well, okay, I took a picture of John in the canoe. Here's a picture of John in the canoe. And, you know, my experiences were very different. So you try to bring both of those to the plate.
Kind of to fill it out.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. You know, you look at music and you think about a musician that comes in and they've got a great vibe that they're playing. But a producer can come in and say, boy, if we change this or if we highlight that, it can improve it. And so that's kind of what the writer and photographer was doing in Paddle North is trying to play off of each other's strengths and then put them together so they made a single product.
Yeah, I always wonder what the bass player is doing. He's never in rhythm with the other guys.
He's usually standing out in the hall somewhere,
yeah.
Basically.
Boom, we're doing his own thing. That must be Lane.
Writers are no different.
Yeah.
No. Lane's the lead guitar.
Oh, he's the lead guitar. There we go. Yeah. You know, I did get a chance to go through the book somewhat today, and I was kind of hit by that photograph of the fox in the Ham Lake fire, who is described down there as, you know, having burned his feet, trying to get away. And it's photographs like that, like, oh, man, you know, and you see that blackened background. But have you been back to that area since?
Oh, yeah, several times. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was just up at 2 weeks ago on SAG with my family. And came back, and that was the first trip for me back to the Boundary Waters since the coverage of the book was finished. It was really neat because, I don't know, I'm not trying to promote anything here, but after my SAG experience up 2 weeks ago with the family, I hadn't been back to the Boundary Waters, hadn't really desired to pick up the camera on this trip. And all of a sudden, it kind of hit me because I wasn't going there to work. I wasn't having to go there to cover anything. I was there with the family, which is where I wanted to be and spend time with them. But after 3 or 4 days, I'm sitting around, everybody's taking a nap. I'm going, well, I need to go do something because I can't just sit. I can't take naps. And so I just picked up the camera and started walking around, and I started finding things. And next thing you know, I was completely lost on my own. And that's a nice place to be once in a while, you know. Well. And so I wrote about this in the blog, just this experience of returning to the Boundary Waters, mm-hmm. not working, but it's still so part of me. And going up there and experiencing the Boundary Waters by going for a 15-minute walk, I mean, I felt completely flushed and refreshed, you know. Everybody woke up from their nap. We had a great fish dinner and, you know, moved on from there. But that's kind of what the Boundary Waters can do to you, you know.
I was struck by one of the dates in your book. I think it was like 1864 through whatever, when most of the Boundary Waters burned. Yep. And then as I was up picking blueberries in the Fire Ham Lake Fire area, there's white pines coming up all over
everywhere.
The place.
We saw that today, everywhere.
And it just reminds you that it takes care of itself in time.
It does. Different time
than our time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, you know, the fox photo that you mentioned, this is, of all of the photos in the book, that's the one I've gotten the most comments on. Mm-hmm. And most of them have been kind of attacks on me for putting that picture in the book. And
really?
I was surprised by that. It kind of hit me on a little different slant, and I wasn't expecting that. And one person from North Dakota wrote and said that I should be ashamed of myself for exploiting the injury of an animal to promote a book. And boy, that hit me on a very raw level. And, you know, my whole point in that book, and to tell you the truth, I really pushed to have that photograph in the book because mm-hmm. I thought it was a very important part of telling the story of fire.
Yeah.
Everybody equates fire with the outfitter burned down, I lost my cabin, I lost my house. You know, the wildlife takes a serious toll as well. And here was an image with this animal that had been caught in the fire, and it was surviving at the point that we were there. And I don't know that I ever felt guilty photographing. I felt terrible for the animal. Mm-hmm. But in photography, one of the great things that we learn is that you have to learn to listen to the messages. And if you can learn to listen to the messages and communicate that to somebody else, you've done your job. And by telling that terrible story visually about an animal that had succumbed to a terrible fire, you told the story. Mm-hmm. But it's funny. People have that impact with wildlife. They are on top of that. And
I think we kind of think that all the animals miraculously escape.
Survive it, right.
But that's not the case.
Yeah. Yeah, so pretty mm-hmm. wild. After the Ham Lake fire, we were up at SAG with Mike Prom on a story we were doing on the Boundary Waters and PMA zones, and we came across an antler on a shoreline in a lake that had been there all summer, and that area had been really, really badly burned. And we looked at that, and we said, why wasn't that eaten by rodents and other critters that eat antlers? And it had been there all summer. This was a fall shoot. And we went, and we kind of came up with the idea that perhaps that area was so burned and the wildlife was decimated, it hasn't returned there yet. Mm-hmm. to eat the things that they normally would eat. Now, whether or not that's true from a biological standpoint or not, ecosystem, I don't know. But you know, when you see something like that that's in an open spot and it should have been consumed by other natural living creatures, you had to sit and ask yourself why. And that was just another one of those unique after effects that came from the fire that you don't anticipate that happens, that, again, kind of opens your eyes in a different way.
It sure does. Well, your latest book, Paddle North, is available just about anywhere.
Just about anywhere, yeah.
And you're teaching a class currently, but you'll be teaching another that is full. You'll be teaching another one in the fall in October.
Correct.
That people can go to North House, to their website, and sign up.
And sign up
if they're interested.
Come up and shoot the fall colors and tell your story for us.
Absolutely. And they can go to your website.
Go to the website, have fun. It's always a fun place to go. I should work on that bio, though.
Well.
Talk about how many cameras I've, you know, ruined.
Well, yeah. I had to do that one from inference, just reading the cover of your book. So anyway, yeah, you work on the bio, but in the meantime, people can go to lanekennedy.com.
Correct.
And see a lot of your shots, whether they're Vietnam or up here or wherever you've been.
Yeah, a little bit of everywhere.
Lane, I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight.
Thanks.
It's been great.
Buck, thank you for having me. It was fun.
And I hope you'll look us up the next time that you're here for more of the same.
I would love to stop at the Roadhouse.
Great.
Great.
Thanks, Lane.
Thanks, guys.